In some of the practice meetings that we've been having, we've both noticed that some of you at least are beginning to explore looking at these processes of the aggregates at work in our experience. And several of you have said, but I don't understand consciousness. And that's the topic for today. I don't know whether this talk will clarify exactly this aggregate of consciousness. We'll see. I'll explore some things with you that have been supportive for my practice, supportive for my own understanding. And supportive of the practice of actually noticing this aggregate at work and experience. Some of this exploration this afternoon will be a little more on the experiential side, and some of it will be more on the conceptual side. And I think I'll begin this talk kind of the way that I ended the last one that I gave. You don't have to remember anything that I say today. Just let it come in. You know, I've experienced some times of teachings in my own practice where a teacher said something and I kind of thought about it and worked with it and, you know, and then forgot about it for a year or so. And then in one sitting, in one place, in a time, 2 years later, that thought of what the teacher said arose in my mind. I wasn't looking for anything or trying to think of anything. It just arose in my mind. And it was the thing that could be seen in that moment. So sometimes the instructions, they're heard. As I said, they come like Dharma rain, and sometimes they sprout 2 years later. So you don't have to try to grasp all the information. So consciousness, this aggregate of knowing, process of knowing, in some ways, I think Gil has said it's kind of a mysterious, I think he's used that word, mysterious experience or process of the mind. What it is, how it's described. In the suttas, there's a description of six kinds of consciousness. There's consciousness connected with each of the sense bases. So there's seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness, smelling consciousness, tasting consciousness, touch consciousness, and consciousness connected to the mind door. It's often understood as just a really bare, simple knowing of experience, just a contact. It's the simple sight, not so much the discerning of what the sight is, but just that there's a sight. There's a sutta. Many of you may be familiar with the Honeyball Sutta, where this process of experience is described with the five aggregates in a way. The beginning of that sutta, or the beginning of that section of the sutta, says, with the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. So there's the eye, the physical eye. There's form in the world, light. And eye consciousness with that creates the contact. There's eye and forms. And eye consciousness, the meeting of the three is contact. So I think of eye consciousness as that kind of, in this description, is kind of like the thing that allows the contact to happen. The just really simple, just so simple, this knowing capacity of our minds connected with each sense base. One of my teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, when people ask him, and this question is often asked, so what's the difference between consciousness and perception or something like that? And Sayadaw Utejaniya would say, well, consciousness is a little bit stupid. You know, it doesn't know much. It just knows. Perception discerns a little bit more. It discerns something. It understands something about what the object is. And consciousness can be understood as this really just simple, simple knowing aspect of experience. So every experience we have, every single experience, there is some experience, we could call it an object, some experience, a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, something going on in our minds, a thought, an emotion, a mind state, an arising. There's the object, and then there is the knowing of it. These two are understood to arise together. An object and the knowing of it. An object and the knowing of it. It's possible for us to, or it's possible for the mind to recognize or know the difference between, let's say, for awareness, mindfulness, to know the difference between the object and the knowing of the object. They happen together, but they're not the same thing. It's like they're different sides of a process going on. So there's the knowing and the object, the knowing and the object. The object, I'd say, is usually more obvious, easier for awareness to pick out or discern aspects of the object of experience. But awareness can also recognize or know, understand, feel, see, sense, use different words for this. Awareness can recognize the awareness or the knowing side of the experience as well. Recognize the knowing side of the experience. Just that simple, bare kind of knowing. So this can be, we can explore this a little bit in our experience. It doesn't have to be a big project. It can be something to play with occasionally. One way into playing with noticing or recognizing the knowing side of the experience is something that Joseph Goldstein has suggested. That when we recognize an experience, an object of experience, he calls it using the passive voice. Seeing happening, instead of the kind of the recognition of it as seeing is happening, he suggests that we kind of recognize seeing is known. That is using a little bit of thought, a little bit of conceptualization, bringing that. It's like a little bit more detailed note in a way. Seeing is known. Hearing is known. It kind of can incline the awareness to touch into or pick up on the knowing side of the experience. So right now, as you're sitting here, what is most obvious in your experience? Maybe hearing the sound of my voice, or some body sensation. Just aware of that, maybe exploring a little bit. Sensation is known. There may not be a sense of the knowing itself there. That's okay. It's just something to play with occasionally. For myself, I found there was a really interesting exploration of this in recognizing using this kind of practice around a hindrance, around noticing aversion in the mind. I was practicing quite a lot with aversion arising. And in this one sitting, I was noticing a lot of it. So it's like, okay, yep, aversion is happening, aversion, aversion. Noticing the unpleasant quality that was there with the aversion, the contraction in the body, all of that. And then something brought in the interest to explore it from the perspective of aversion is known. And the interest was kind of triggers like, oh, and there's aversion happening. Aversion is known. Aversion is known. And the interest landed a little more on the knowing of the aversion. Had a very interesting effect on the feeling tone of the experience. Because in that moment, as the attention was kind of more in the knowing than in the aversion was still arising, but the experience became neutral because the knowing of aversion is neutral. That was a kind of an interesting recognition that where the attention was essentially shaped or flavored the feeling tone more clearly. So the attention on the aversion itself, feeling tone unpleasant. Attention connected to the knowing of the feeling tone. Knowing of the aversion, feeling tone neutral. It was quite interesting to see that shift. So this is something you can play with a little bit. And don't go too crazy with it. You know, sometimes we might, you know, get a taste of it or get a sense of, oh, this is what it means to see the knowing. Sometimes we can stumble into it. You know, it's like, oh, this is the mind can do this. The mind can do this. The mind can recognize the knowing of experience. It can recognize the experience and the knowing of the experience. And sometimes it can naturally or easily sometimes switch between those. Sometimes it's easily available to see the knowing. Sometimes it's not easily available to see the knowing. I think it's usually becomes easier to see the knowing side of the experience when the mindfulness is fairly established. Bill was talking about that, the establishment of awareness, the establishment of mindfulness this morning. The continuity of mindfulness, when it becomes more effortless, when that momentum of mindfulness, we're in the state of awareness. We're not having to work at it. It's happening, the effortless quality of that state. That is the, it's much easier to see something as subtle as the knowing when there is that continuity of mindfulness. And so sometimes we can see it, sometimes we can't. It's also, you know, something that it's everywhere. It's happening in every moment. Every moment of experience has a knowing. So in some ways, it's kind of like, you know, the proverbial water that the fish is swimming in and not aware that they're swimming in. It's so present. It's so here that we just don't recognize it. Sometimes it's that kind of quality. And so we're not trained to recognize it. And so it can be hard to see. And yet when we do begin to see it, sometimes it's like, oh my gosh, how could I have missed this? How could I have missed it? And then we might try to start doing that, doing the seeing of the knowing. And yeah, you might give yourself a headache with that one. So just really light touch on this. But it can be fun to play with sometimes. It can be fun to play with that exploration. Aversion is known. Seeing is known. Hearing is known. There's an understanding in, particularly in the commentaries and the Buddhist Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, that these moments of object and knowing, object and knowing, object and knowing, that they are, they're happening very rapidly. Of the understanding that experience is made up of very rapidly arising and passing moments of consciousness and object, consciousness and object, consciousness and object, consciousness and object, really, really rapidly, like so rapidly you can't even fathom how rapidly. I think one of the commentaries says something like, there are 17 trillion mind moments in the blink of an eye. So that's pretty fast. Lots of mind moments in there. And yet there is this understanding, and this is a piece that is useful to understand, not necessarily to try to dive in there and see, can I see 17 trillion mind moments in the blink of an eye? I understand there are some some people with very, very strong concentration who say they can see mind moments arising and passing. But the understanding here that's important to understand is that there is not a continuous consciousness. There's moments of consciousness that arise with an object, and the consciousness passes with that object. This is the psychological understanding in the Buddhist, in the Theravada Buddhist world. Moment of consciousness, object that arises and ceases. So there is not a stable anything. Now, the fact that there are so many mind moments in the blink of an eye, we're not going to see that most of the time. We're not going to see how many mind moments, and that this consciousness is arising every single moment, every single one of those 17 trillion moments, consciousness is arising with an object. It can feel very stable. And so there can be this sense or stability of a kind of a field of consciousness that things arise in. This is a perception. This is a way it can feel. And it's fine that it feels that way. Sometimes that's a way that we can kind of stabilize, touch into that knowing quality, have this sense of a stable field of knowing and experience arising and passing in that field. And it can seem very persuasive in a way that, wow, I've experienced that with my own. Like, I was pretty deeply in there, concentrated. And yeah, that consciousness, that is the ground. That is the bottom. You know, that is where we can land. And the Buddha cautioned us in one sutta. He cautioned us against views that are formed based on meditative experience. So this idea, perhaps, of, wow, I feel this field of just knowing. So it must be there. It must be real. Kind of like Gil's analogy the other day, that feeling of that line in the meditation hall. You know, feeling like it's there. And then it's exploded. That idea that it's there is exploded. I mean, it was a direct, he described it as a direct experience. You'd get to it, it's like a vibrating body. Nope, don't go there. That sense of, I've directly experienced it, so it is a thing. That the Buddha cautioned us about, especially coming out of deep meditative experiences. He cautioned us about reifying or creating a reality out of that. And so the teachings really point us to understand the impermanent nature of all aspects of our experience, the aggregates, all what we experience in our lives, the aggregates coming and going, impermanent, unreliable, not a place to land to say, that is the place where I can finally land and say, yep, that's where I can rest. I can rest on that thing. So there's this momentary arising and passing of objects. and consciousness. Object knowing. Now, our idea about this momentary nature of consciousness, a split second, you know, the smaller than a split second arising of object and experience. Our minds maybe make the idea that that is a really small thing. Kind of create the idea that it's a really small thing. That's going to be the tiniest little pixel of experience, kind of like we might think of it like a television screen. And each one of those moments of consciousness is a pixel on that television screen. And that 17 trillions of them might be all of those pixels together. But each pixel is only one little blip of color or something like that. You know, so we might think of those moments of consciousness as being this tiny little thing, a tiny little like sensation, a tiny little sight, a tiny little sound, something like that. Maybe that's the way it is. I don't know. It could be. It could be that's the way it is. Maybe I'll know at some point. But there's another experience that I want to point to. And again, I don't know, you know, like the Buddha encouraged us not to, you know, reify our meditative experiences, but, you know, there's a perhaps a usefulness in pointing to this possibility of experience. So it seems like, you know, a split second of consciousness is vanishingly small. And yet the object, you know, so the object that consciousness knows, if it's since it's such a small thing, we might think of that object being really small. But there are objects that the mind can know that are really vast. The Buddha speaks of immeasurable equanimity, immeasurable love. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, boundless, these qualities of heart. When those arise, I don't think it's a bunch of really tiny little moments of metta. It's like this boundless love is an experience that consciousness can meet in a moment. So, you know, we might think of consciousness as being something really small, but the descriptions of the objects that consciousness meets are vast. Some of the objects that consciousness meets are vast. So perhaps we can have this notion of consciousness not having a shape or size. Maybe consciousness, we can explore the experience of or play with the experience of consciousness having the shape or size of the thing that is it is conscious of. If the consciousness is of the sound of the bird, takes the shape or form somehow of that experience, arises and passes in that form. Maybe with the experience of vast equanimity, consciousness has this vastness to it as well. Well, sometimes in experience, the objects feel really kind of small, like that pressure, that body sensation, that sound. It's like they have little bounds around them. You look up at the night sky and there's a planet and you see the planet and it's like, yep, that's the planet. But some objects, some experiences don't have any boundaries around them. Maybe that in that night sky looking up at the Milky Way, the vastness of it. There's kind of a relaxation of, in a way, when I look up at the Milky Way, it feels like the eyes relax to take it in. And it doesn't focus on some little part of the Milky Way. It doesn't appreciate the Milky Way in that way. It's a vast experience. Sometimes when we are aware that the experiences, the objects that we're recognizing have this quality of seeming very precise, very clear, sometimes they have this experience of seeming really vast or diffuse or even vague or not precise at all. And that's, I don't think of that as a flaw in the experience or in the awareness and the mindfulness of the experience. It's like, maybe this is the mind knowing some really fuzzy object. Sleepiness has this quality. Sleepiness kind of feels fuzzy. So the knowing of sleepiness, vast kind of, sleepiness doesn't seem to have any edges to it. So just this vast sense of fuzz, fog, something like that. The knowing is not affected by what it knows. It's just, it's happy to reflect. It's happy to know that experience. And then mindfulness uses the aspect of knowing. I think of mindfulness as using feeling, perception, and consciousness really to meet experience. And so when the consciousness is connecting with a vast object like equanimity or sleepiness, a diffuse object, a vague object, the consciousness maybe has that quality of being very large and the object seems very fuzzy. So the idea, sometimes I think we have an idea with being mindful that there's a lot of precision, you know, everything that I see would be really clear, really sharp. And in my experience, you know, that's not all the objects. All the objects aren't that clear and sharp. So it's not a mistake. You can know, consciousness can know sleepiness. Consciousness can know vast love. Another interesting piece around this experience, this, you know, object and knowing happening moment after moment after moment. We often will think of perhaps that, you know, the knowing, the way we're talking about, the knowing is kind of what lets us see the object, right? I mean, it's kind of like that's the illumination. The knowing is the illumination that lets us see the object. It's like the knowing is the light that lets us see the thing, the object, the experience, the sight, the sound, the smell, the taste, the touch. Yet there's an interesting thing that these things arise together. You know, they arise together. It's not like consciousness arises and then the object comes into it. They come up together. And so while there is the kind of sense or kind of understanding of the consciousness illuminating experience, sometimes we can have the recognition that the object or the experience also shows us, reveals to us, that there's knowing happening. When there's an object present, knowing has to be present. So sometimes we can have the sense of the object illuminating or pointing out the knowing. I'm going to create an image for you. This experience, it's an experience I had that became a meditation teaching and supported my meditation in the days following this experience. So I was meditating in the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, and it was January. I had a little cabin on a hill. And unusually, I mean, it got very cold for many days running. It did not go above freezing for like 5 days in a row, and it had snowed about 8 inches. Very dry also, really light snow. The sun didn't come out for days. It was really cold. And then one day, you know, the sun finally came out. It was still below freezing, but the sun came out, so it began warming the snow on the trees. And it was really still also, so all the snow had stayed on the trees. It was gorgeous. I mean, it was really beautiful. I was walking around the woods and just delighted with the experience of being in this beautiful nature. On that day that the sun came out, the snow started falling off the trees, you know, dropping, made this lovely sound, and you know, I could kind of see it falling in the distance. And then as I was sitting in my little cabin, I had a cabin that had was pretty much windows on all of the sides. And I was looking out the window into the courtyard of the cabin. And it was all trees over the courtyard. There was no sun coming into the courtyard at all. And yet the snow started falling off the trees through the air, dropping in the courtyard. And as the snow fell, there were these moments where, as the snow fell, and it blew a little bit because there was just a tiny bit of breeze, that it would reveal that there was sunlight coming through the trees into the courtyard. I couldn't see any sunlight. When there wasn't snow falling, there was no sunlight that I could see. I was a little confused. It's like, well, there's sun there. Where, you know, there's no sun in there. Where is it? And there was a deck on the cabin. So I went out on the deck and I looked over the edge of the deck, and there were several spots of sun underneath the deck. So the sun had been coming in at an angle through the courtyard. So I could not see the sun until the snow fell through it. And then it would vanish again. The sun, no apparent sun. And then the snow would fall and I'd see the sun rays illuminated again. And this was a case where we normally think of, we need light in order to see the object. In this case, the object of the snow falling showed me where the light was. And so that image kind of supported my kind of recognition in my practice. It's like, oh, there's an object. There is knowing with it. That knowing can be, the object is revealing the knowing. The object can reveal the knowing. The suttas offer a set of beautiful analogies for the aggregates. We're going to probably unpack these in more detail in the second time we go through these aggregates. We're going to do a second pass through the aggregates. But I wanted to bring in the analogy for consciousness today and just look at it just a little bit. And it's a It's the analogy of the magic show. The suttas say something like, anyone who observes a magic show carefully, with good eyesight, someone looks at a magic show, sees the magic, you know, like Gil said yesterday, you know, you see the magic, and when you see the magic, it's not interesting anymore. These similes are kind of pointers to the empty nature, the insubstantial nature, the coreless nature of the aggregates. And he said, like you would upon seeing a magician, seeing the magic, and a person who understands, who really understands what's going on there, is not going to be fooled by that. They're going to see that as empty and void and insubstantial. I'm going to see a magic show as that. And he would say, just so, consciousness is also insubstantial, empty, void. But there is something the teachings in the sutta kind of point to, in a way, the way each of these aggregates has its kind of way that it fools us when we're not clearly seeing. Consciousness fools us like a magic show fools us. And so this one is interesting to me, this kind of analogy. It's like, what does it mean that consciousness is like a magic show? And what is a magic show? And how does it work? And so just a couple aspects of the magic show simile that resonated for me a little bit. One is that a magician kind of weaves things together, does many things at the same time, and pulls focus so that you're not looking somewhere when he's doing something else. So there's a lot of things going on, and there's a weaving together of some experience that is not what is happening, but makes you think it's what's happening. So that's kind of the way a magic show works. And thinking about consciousness, this image came to my mind, or this sense of, especially with sight, you know, we know so much from our history. Like I look at a wall, I look at this wall, and I see the wall. I see it, but you know, just the sight of it doesn't necessarily give me much information. But I have known in the past many experiences, other experiences with walls. Like I've run up against them and found out they're hard. So I've got that memory of the hardness of it from past contact with it. I know its solidity. You know, I push on it and I know, yeah, not going to go through that. So when I look at that wall, the way, and this is maybe really useful. I mean, again, you know, some of these ways that our mind works, it weaves things together. You know, so I see the wall and I cannot distinguish, in a way, there's a weaving together of all of the prior recollections of walls. So I look at that wall and I know it's hard. My body would not like run full force at that wall, because I know it would hurt if I hit it. So that it's kind of like there's this weaving together of this, the various threads of sense experience, to create some coherent package of what we're seeing. Our sense experience is kind of put together of independent threads, and our mind somehow weaves it together to make sense of it. And it's useful that it does that. But it is a weaving together. And in some ways, I think the magic is that we believe what it has woven together to be a reality, to be something external, out there, real. When what we are actually experiencing is what our mind has created. And I'm not saying that I should like run fast at that wall, because I'll like end up with a headache, maybe some broken bones. So it's useful. And yet there is a way in which we believe this weaving to be something that it is not. A consciousness, knowing, arising with an object. Consciousness is dependent on the I informs. Consciousness is dependent on the ear and sound. Every sense base, there's a dependent nature. It arises in connection with something. It's not random. It's conditioned. This is another useful understanding . The teaching around the aggregates points to mental formations shaping all of the other aggregates, including consciousness. This is also expressed in a teaching some of you may be familiar with, dependent origination, where in that chain of steps that describes the kind of the arising of suffering, how suffering is created in our experience, in that chain of steps, the link, consciousness is found in that chain, and the link that precedes consciousness is mental formations. With mental formation as condition, consciousness arises, consciousness comes to be. So this reflects that teaching in around the aggregates, the verb nature of the aggregates. Mental formations form or construct, mental constructions construct. What do they construct? They construct form, they construct feeling, they construct perception, they construct constructions, and they construct consciousness. So mental formations, the generating thing, shapes consciousness. Now, what does that mean? My understanding of this is that the mental formations are shaping or inclining us to recognize certain aspects of experience. So, for instance, if we have a mental formation of anger going on in our minds, then that mental formation, that construction, is tending, that constructs a lot of things. It constructs possibly the body feeling tense and tight. It probably constructs unpleasant feeling. It constructs the tendency to perceive things from that perception, from that flavor of anger. You know, if you see somebody's face, you might perceive them as being a threat because there's the anger in your mind. And it also what tends to condition more anger, and perhaps it also tends to condition us to be conscious of things that are things that anger kind of wants to be connected to. Kind of like a filter on our consciousness. The filter of anger is selecting certain things out of experience and letting certain things become conscious and other things not become conscious. In our present day psychology, this is called selective attention. And there's lots of studies done on it, that there are even something as simple as an agenda, a task you're given to do, can shape what you are conscious of. So there's a famous study about this. Many of you have heard about this study, I'm sure, but I'll describe it now. So people were asked to watch a video, and they were asked to count the number of times that a basketball passed between players wearing a white shirt. There were two teams on the floor. They were asked to count the number of times the basketball passed between the players who wore the white shirts. So the basketball was being passed between both teams, and there's a little bit of focus there. You had to be aware of where the basketball was, which team member was holding it, whether they were passing it to a person on the team with the white shirt. So an agenda to do this, but you know, nothing terribly emotional, just an agenda to solve this problem. When the video finished, most people could correctly answer the question about how many times the basketball passed between the players in the white shirts. A few of the people also kind of said something like, was there like a gorilla in that video? And indeed, there had been a person in a gorilla suit that kind of walked into the middle of the game and had kind of danced around for a little bit and then walked off, like not subtle at all, really right in the middle of this video. And so most of the people, I mean, some number of the people, like, I don't know, maybe 20% actually kind of saw the gorilla there. But if you focused on the gorilla, you lost track of the basketball, right? I mean, so most people were focused on the basketball and did not see the gorilla. Absolutely did not see the gorilla. I've seen some of the, they've done, you can look some of these things up online, and they've got different variations on a theme where you don't know what's going to change or whatever. And boy, it'll fool you. You know, it's quite amazing how like a completely different person could appear and you wouldn't even recognize that it was a different person or something. It's our attention just is not very good at picking things up. We think it is. So this video, actually, one of the other interesting pieces is that when the video was played back to people, and then yes, you can, you know, when you're not trying to count the number of times the basketball's passing, you are gonna see the gorilla. And some of the people, not all by any means, I mean, some of the people, but some number, like 25% of the people or something, said that has to be a different video because they so trusted their own sense apparatus, right? I mean, I would have seen that. I would have seen that if that was the video. That's the magic show, too. You know, that's that belief in our sense experience. In this case, an agenda screened out a piece of the experience. The agenda had the attention at a certain thing, not seeing the other piece of it. So this is the shaping of consciousness. Our mental formations shape what we become conscious of. We are not conscious of everything. This is humbling. And yet it's important for us to recognize this. And not simply believe that we would have seen something, for instance. So there's so much about the shaping of experience, understanding how our experience is shaped in this way. Even our very consciousness, the very consciousness is shaped. It begins to help us to not cling to our experience, to see that consciousness is coming into being, independence on other things, independence on our moods, independence on our agendas. It's being shaped. And it is so rapidly changing that there actually isn't anything stable or solid there. This doesn't keep us from identifying with it. But perhaps as we can see both the conditioned nature of these aggregates and the impermanent nature, as we see that, it does weaken the identification. It weakens the tendency to cling. So this is our first kind of step in a way in exploring the aggregates, is get to know them, to know them as processes, working, weaving together, seeing them for what they are. And not me, not mine, not who I am, just processes doing their thing. The mind begins to let go of that tendency to identify, tendency to cling, tendency to suffer. To struggle with our experience, wanting it to be a certain way, feeling like we've made a mistake, failed somehow when it is shown to us that experience is impermanent and unreliable and uncontrollable. We find out That's just the nature of experience. And so our minds begin to align with that truth, those truths, impermanent, unreliable, not self. And in that alignment, so much freedom, ease and peace. Let's just sit for a moment. Thank you for your practice, your willingness to be curious about your experience.